Welcome in to Locked On Knicks Mailbag Monday. I'm Alex Wolf. He's Gavin Shaw. We're here with you on this Monday morning. There was the game last night, obviously, against the Heat, but we're going to hold off on that. We're just going to do a double game review for Tuesday morning, and we're going to get into some mailbag questions because we decided that we'd rather have a little more fun tonight on this recording. So we're going to do that. We've got some good questions for you. We're going to lead off with a very, what I'm sure will be a polarizing question, and answering what is Carmelo Anthony's legacy as a Knick? Where does he rank amongst New York legends? And does he deserve have his jersey number retired?
And then we get into the realm of weird. Vive LeFranc, shout out to him. It's 1'7'3" Kristaps Porzingis or 87'1" Kristaps Porzingis. And then we're going to tell you who is Hugmore as a kid. Between Mario Hezonja and Tim Hardaway.
And then lastly, we'll finish up by debating over which current Knick is most likely to send back poorly made food at a restaurant, and also which Knick would be most likely to just eat whatever is served and not say a word. I got to say, whoever gets that second honor is who I would be most akin to, because I never send my food back. But we'll get into that and more coming up in a minute here on Locked On Knicks.
You are Locked On Knicks, your daily New York Knicks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Knox foul from behind, counting and one, as Fisdale pumps his fist.
Milikina.
What he does is contagious, like.
To Trier. Trier drives down. Oh!
All right, so welcome in to Locked On Knicks. I'm Alex. He's Gavin. We're doing some mailbag questions today on this Mailbag Monday. And feel free. So we put out prompts for mailbag questions when we're getting ready to do episodes. We're probably going to do another one this coming week for the trade deadline. So if anything strikes you, even if we don't have a tweet out yet for it, for mailbag questions, and you just feel like asking us over the course of this next week something related to the trade deadline, feel free to hit us up. We're at Locked On Knicks on Twitter. We're Locked On Knicks at gmail.com if you want to email trades to us, the old snail mail of today, as it seems, compared to the other ways to get things across now. But yeah, just hit us up. But for now, we've got some questions from this week, thankfully, some of which are pretty light, but this one is pretty heavy by comparison. So got a question here from Daniel at 5000 BRRRR. So I'll read that as at 5000 BRRRR. And his question is, what is Carmelo Anthony's legacy as a Knick? Where does he rank amongst New York legends? And does he deserve to have his jersey number retired? Swag, swag, swag. I don't know what swag, swag, swag is, but I dig it. So this is a pretty complicated question. I'll just give just his career averages real quick, Gavin, and then I'll hand this over to you. He averaged 24.7 points per game as a Knick, which is second behind only Bernard King for the team all time. I did not count Bob McAdoo in that because he played, if I'm not mistaken, only parts of two seasons here. So I don't really count him towards the all-time list, despite the fact that he did, in fact, play for the Knicks, and he averaged something like 28, 29 points a game. Although, to be fair, Bernard King, I think, only played parts of four seasons here, so it's not that big of a difference, but whatever. It's all kind of semantics at that point. He averaged 7 rebounds, 3.2 assists, shot 44% from the floor, 37% from three, and had a 545 true shooting percentage in his time as a Knick. And he won one scoring title in the 12-13 season. Also, just to consider, he had 7 seasons with the Knicks, or parts of 7 seasons, I should say. It's really like 6.5. He had 3 playoff appearances, 6 All-Star appearances. And technically, I mean, the first year that he was here, he was also an All-Star, but he appeared in the All-Star game as a Nugget and then was promptly traded to the Knicks. So that's where we're at. So I'll pass to you, Gavin, to kind of get opening arguments going here about Melo, but I just figured I'd set the table with stats there.
Yeah, this is obviously, it's such a loaded conversation. I feel like we could honestly, like, over the summer, do this as like a series and like have like a 10 to 20 episode breakdown of Carmelo Anthony's career, his legacy, the implications of it. And maybe we'll do that. But I like getting into the conversation here, I guess. And there's a lot more nuance to it than this. But like if you asked me to give one word to sum up his tenure as a Knick, I would say disappointment. And I think that's mostly not on him. It was a lot of factors out of his control. The one year he had kind of a semi-competent group around him, 2012, 2013, that was the most fun Knicks team of my lifetime, at least that I can remember, which was like post-2002. And I mean, just that group with Jason Kidd, Amon Shumpert, Tyson Chandler, Steve Novak, Kurt Thomas, Pablo Pringles, Prigioni, Fat Ray Felton, Chris Copeland, pre-stabbing, glad he's doing okay, and Rasheed Wallace. That was just such a great team. And like in my mind, I think long-term, like right now, like we're still kind of fresh off it. Like there's the whole thing that he can't really play in the NBA anymore because he's just not that good at this point. But I think with a little bit more time to process his career as a Knick and to think about it and to look back on it, I think I'm ultimately going to remember that 2012-13 team more than anything else. And then even that year, you could still use that phrase disappointment because they lost in the second round of the playoffs and didn't get to a seventh game against the Pacers team that was good, but was very, very beatable. But I guess you got to look at the flip side, too. Like, he's also clearly the best Knick of the 21st century. And like, that's something of an indictment on everyone else the Knicks have had in that time. But he's pretty obviously number one. And in that 2012-13 season, you could have made the argument that he deserved, I mean, if LeBron James doesn't exist, serious MVP consideration. 29 points, 7 rebounds, 3 assists a night, 45% from the field, 40% from 3, 85% from the charity stripe. He had that great series of moments against the Bulls. I think it was Easter Eve that year. He hit a 3 with 11 seconds left in regulation to tie the game, then another with 8 seconds left to win it. And to me, that was like almost like the ultimate like distillation of Melo as a Knick, like just when he was on, utterly unstoppable as a scorer, and like all the greatest Knicks, kind of a sense of the moment and a sense of when the Garden would peak. And that's kind of looking at it through, I guess, blue and orange colored glasses, because I also remember missing a million clutch shots over the course of his Knicks career. But those moments that season, I think ultimately, if you ask me to what I'm going to remember 20, 30 years down the road, I hope, and I think that's ultimately what I'm going to think of.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. I mean, it's, I almost wish we could have James on this episode, because I feel like I am kind of a middle grounder with Melo, and it sounds like you're more pro-Melo than anti-Melo, and James was like massively anti-Melo. I'm kind of a middle grounder with him. I can see the positives. I can see the negatives. I look at his time here, and my sort of takeaway is that I try to just look at what was positive while he was here rather than lingering on what was negative, because I don't really see the point of harboring too much bad blood for him at this point. Clearly, it's a guy that wanted to be here, but also you could argue took the wrong way to get here, which soured people right away. The fact that he sort of leveraged saying that he would accept a trade to and then extend with the Nets as well as the Knicks at the time was what forced the Knicks to give up the big package that they did for him. And, you know, you could argue that it was almost, it, depending on how this coming offseason goes for the Knicks, like you could definitely see that the Knicks could be in a similar position going into next year that they were in that 2010-11 season, where they had a really pretty solid young core full of guys, signed a couple free agents, and the team looked like it was going to at least be exciting. And then they sort of just gutted that whole thing to trade for Melo. And ultimately, when you look at like how they did in that first part of that season, granted it was before Mari had broken down, and obviously that was just kind of, his knees were a ticking time bomb and they went off really early. Like by the end of that first season, his knees and his back were already like exploded essentially. But you know, it's just, it's tricky to look at because he came here and for those first three seasons made the playoffs, and then for the last four didn't. So when you're comparing him to some of the great Knicks out there that you think of, like the Clyde Fraziers and the Patrick Ewings, and even if you go to like Willis Reed, Dave DeBuscher, Earl Pearl Monroe, like John Starks, the thing with all those guys is that they had consistent success on the record book. You know what I mean? Like they had lots of winning seasons, lots of playoff appearances, lots of deep playoff runs. In the case of those 1970s guys, they had two titles. It's just, I think that's the biggest part of Melo's resume that's lacking. And that's like the one of the main reasons I think that people dislike him for his time here. The other thing too is that he had kind of the inability to realize sort of the changing landscape of the NBA, and kept playing the game the way that he wanted to play the game rather than fitting into some roles that would work better for him. Like that whole 2012-13 season was essentially an accident, like that it worked out that well. And it was only because Amari got hurt right away and was hurt for pretty much the whole season that Melo got shifted down to the four that year. And playing small like that, I mean, the Knicks sort of weirdly low-key set a blueprint for what has become the way of playing today in the NBA, which was kind of spreading the floor. And, you know, Melo was like a small ball four. They just had like a rim-running defensive center in Tyson Chandler. So, you know, even his best year was sort of a happy accident in a way, because he would have preferred to play small forward his whole time with the Knicks. But anyway, I, at the risk of getting too long-winded on this point, and obviously I'll get back to it in a minute, but like, there were so many times that I did look back on that I liked from him. Like even Kristaps Porzingis' first year on my site, Posting and Toasting, before I was writing there, Seth, who used to run the site, took to calling him Dad Melo. And I mean, I look back fondly on that year, even though it wasn't a pretty year. The first year with Porzingis, with Robin Lopez and all that. Even the year that they had Bargnani, that they didn't make the playoffs, mostly because of like Bargnani and others. Melo like played his heart out that season and tried his hardest, and they got within like the last day of the season of making the playoffs that year. So I have a lot of fond memories. I have some not so fond memories, but all in all, like, I think it more or less evens out, and I'm to the point where I don't harbor enough ill will towards Melo that it would ever affect like my overall viewpoint of him and make me like not appreciate the good stuff.
Yeah, it's funny, and I think your kind of assumption on me being pro Melo was 100% reasonable given what I said, but like anyone who went to high school with me would probably just like laugh if they heard someone describe me that way, because I was probably like, I would just like, whenever he'd be brought up, like, I thought people who, I mean, again, outside that 2012-13 year was my senior year of high school, but even I guess before that, and then like after that through college, like anytime someone brought up Melo in like a positive light, I would just kind of look at them and be like, okay, you clearly like don't understand basketball, because there's like, I mean, there's so many, like, I mean, I think you kind of summed it up perfectly. Like, he wanted to be a Knick and he wanted to win as a Knick, but he was only willing to do that on his own terms, that ultimately prevented him from at least initially being really successful, and then in some ways prevented long-term success. Though I guess the point I was trying to make last time I was talking was that I think he was going up against so much with the Knicks, just NBA worst infrastructure. And I mean, anyone who thinks that that's not an accurate description needs to go back and look at basically the last 17, 18 years of Knicks basketball, because that's just been the reality of the situation. So I guess I'm of two minds on it, that Melo was spectacular as a Knick. I do genuinely believe that he wanted to win and he wanted to put the team first, and that simultaneously he didn't always do that and didn't make decisions that were always conducive to winning. And then on top of that, even if he had, I think he ultimately would have been let down by the Knicks infrastructure. And I guess because of that and because of the system that he was operating in, I kind of choose to remember the positives, even though I think the more logical part of my brain tells me that he was disappointing in so many ways. And like, if you want to look at it as a collective, and I don't want to just shine the light on that 2012-13 season, there was like a lot of time where people across, like, I guess Knicks fans collectively disliked him, and I personally disliked him. So I guess all of this is a way of saying is we're not going to be able to parse this out in one segment, and it's just an extraordinarily complicated legacy that he's left behind.
Yeah. Well, let me first off apologize for misconstruing you as someone who is maybe all in all pro Melo.
No, but it's a fair assumption based on what I said. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, this is the first time we're talking about this on air or otherwise. So, you know, we're getting through this live on air. You guys are seeing how the sausage is made, how we how we tell each other about, you know, players and stuff and figure out what we like and don't like as two people who hadn't met before this podcast. But at any point or at any rate, I don't know. It's such a complicated legacy. Like the biggest thing is he never took a pay cut of any type. Or he took one. He turned down his first to second year raise on that contract with the no trade clause. But he also got a no trade clause out of it. So, you know, that's like his one sacrifice that he made to the team. But I do think, like you said, I think he legitimately did want to win as a Knick, and that's valuable and that's worth, you know, commending in some ways. And he definitely loves the city, and he loved playing at the Garden. And I mean, it was just nice to see it. For all of his flaws, Carmelo was a superstar. Like at his peak, he was one of the, you know, probably top 10 to 15 players in the league, and he was playing for the Knicks. And so it was good to finally, after so long, have a player like that that was so happy to play his home games at Madison Square Garden, you know, and really appreciated what that means, because I don't think that too many guys, I mean, clearly you see the number of star free agents and whatever that could have had their chance to play here that never did. And, you know, you kind of realize that it takes a certain type of guy to be built to, you know, play here and to be able to deal with the media scrutiny and, you know, the fact that you have a zillion fans like micromanaging or, you know, microanalyzing every little thing that you're doing and all that. And Melo kind of leaned into that, and he was kind of that perfect, like, level-headed, don't-give-a-fuck type of guy that, you know, he didn't really care what the fans and the media and stuff were saying about him to most extents. The only thing that ever really seemed to get under his skin truly was Phil Jackson towards the end of his tenure. Like, he definitely did not like Phil Jackson and did not like how Phil Jackson talked about him, I guess. And however you feel about that is a whole separate topic. But, yeah, I think we're starting to push the limits of doing this in one segment. I think we ought to just push this to after commercial. So we'll take a quick break. You guys are locked on Knicks, your daily home for the New York Knicks. And we'll be back in just a moment.
Thanks for sticking with us on the Locked On Knicks podcast. Gavin Shaw, Alex Wolf here with you. And we are discussing Carmelo Anthony's legacy on this Mailbag Monday edition of the Locked On Knicks podcast. Last segment, we threw a lot of information out at you. Some of it was disconnected. Alex, fortunately, was a lot more coherent than I was, because I think I contradicted myself like a million times over the course of that first segment. But in a lot of ways, that was the Carmelo Anthony experience. He was full of contradictions. But Alex, I kind of want to boil down all the mishmash we threw out last time around and kind of come to some conclusions. I guess I'll start off by asking you this. Where do you rank Carmelo Anthony amongst all-time Knicks?
Yeah, this is so first off, the way that the question was phrased from Daniel, once again, at 5,000 burr, swag, swag, swag. it was phrased as, where does he rank amongst New York legends? And that is entirely too hard to figure out. So I'm going to read it as you did and say New York Knicks legends, because trying to figure out his place among the Knicks, now the Nets, the Yankees, the Mets, the Rangers, the Islanders, freaking it's Jets, Giants. I mean, just ridiculous. Too many things to figure out there.
Yeah, answer would have to be that he doesn't, I think, if you want to expand it that far out, like at least in a meaningful way. Like you want to talk somewhere in like the 20s, like late 20s, early 30s, fine. But.
Yeah. I mean, and I wouldn't even care to try to, just the goddamn Yankees by themselves. Apologies to any Yankee and Knicks fans that listen to the show. I'm a Mets fan.
Brent Gardner's one, and let's just work from there.
Yeah. So anyway, so I've got, I mean, I flip flop all the time between Clyde and Ewing is number one, but it's kind of like a 1A and 1B situation, no matter who you pick as the top guy out of those two. Like, those two are, I think, undeniably the top two Knicks of all time. And I can't see anybody taking that over in the near future unless Porzingis goes on to be like a 10-time All-Star, which, you know, hopefully he does. Like, 10-time All-Star Hall of Famer leads us to a number of playoff appearances, stuff like that. But those two are like undeniably, for the foreseeable future, you're one and two.
I might have Willis Reed ahead of Patrick Ewing, but we can talk.
No way. I was going to say Reed is for sure your third. I think Reed is for sure number three. Because he had a very good career that burned very bright, but it was very short. Yeah. Like, it's not, you can't, I don't think, and not to, this could be a whole nother episode some other time,
sure.
But I don't think you can really compare Reed to Ewing, because Reed, and I mean, it was no thanks to injuries and stuff, but I mean, his career really only lasted about 6-7 seasons, and then he had to retire, and he burned really hot at his peak. And obviously he won the two titles with the Knicks, and he had those legendary moments and everything. But Patrick Ewing, I mean, he played like forever, like, and he just never, right up until the very, very end, he just never broke down for the Knicks, despite being like their only guy that you could really call star for the longest time. So that's why I think he's your one or 1A, or, sure, you know, whatever. But anyway, so after those three, then I think that's where you can start considering Melo a little bit. But then, so like there's three guys I think that can for sure be in consideration from the title teams, and that's Earl the Pearl Monroe, Dave DeBuscher, and Bill Bradley. And then I also would, just for how much fans love him, and I'll fully admit, like, so I was born in 1990, so most of the 90s era Knicks, and I wasn't raised in like a basketball household, so like I had to get into basketball on my own. So I didn't really get into it until like the finals run in 99, and at that point Starks was already off the team anyway. But I know that Starks holds a lot of, you know, a lot of clout with a lot of fans, just because they loved him. They loved his workmanlike demeanor, and the fact that he was just like a mean dude who hit threes and scored a bunch of points and played super awesome defense and all that stuff. So I would probably put him in the discussion as well. I would say I'd probably put Melo at fifth. And I think I would put him behind Clyde, Ewing, Reed, and I think I would put Earl the Pearl in there as well. Just even though he had a relatively brief Knicks career, he was such a part of them winning the titles, and he was such a good player alongside Clyde, and they found such good chemistry. I think I'd put him in that spot. But you could also make a case for, I think, DeBuscher. I think Bradley, you know, he was a good player. He had one All-Star appearance, but he was never like the guy like Melo was. And neither was DeBuscher, to be fair, but I think DeBuscher was just a little better than Bradley. But yeah, I think I'd put Earl the Pearl there. And then that's not to disrespect Bernard King either, but I look at Bernard King as a dude who, like, he made the one significant playoff appearance where they went to, I think it was the second round, and he like played his heart out against the Celtics and they wound up losing. But then a lot of his career with the Knicks was mired with injury. He had an ACL tear back when ACL tears were more of a big, like, career threatening injury. And that sort of derailed his time with the Knicks. And
he only ended up playing four seasons with them.
Yeah. I would still for sure put King in the top 10. I know that'll probably rub a lot of like 80s Knicks fans the wrong way, but I just don't really have much attachment to King.
Sure.
And you know, it's just by virtue of like when I was born and when I got into the Knicks and all that. But yeah, that's to wrap up here. We'll do another one sometime where we rank like our top 15 Knicks of all time or something. But just in terms of Melo, I'd probably put him either like at five, like to put him in the top five, or like just barely looking outside of the top five.
Yeah, I have him at six. I have Clyde, I think, fairly clear number one, Willis versus Ewing. I certainly get the argument for Ewing. I think it's 100% reasonable. I'm of the opinion, like, I'll take peak over all else. And the Knicks have won two championships in their history. Willis Reed was the MVP of both of those teams. And I mean, you could certainly make an argument that bigs were kind of overvalued at that time, and Clyde was actually the best player on both of those teams. And like, certainly in the first championship where Reed kind of got it for sentimental value, where he comes on the court, kind of shocks the Lakers. And Clyde had what, like 38, 17, like seven steals in that game. Just one of the single greatest NBA finals performances forever. But either way you want to spin it, those were far and away the two most integral guys to the two Knicks teams that won titles. Patrick Ewing was great. He had great highs. He had great peaks. But kind of similar to Melo, where just relative to expectations, and keep in mind expectations for Ewing were that he was going to be one of the 10 greatest players of all time and one of the two or three greatest centers of all time. So probably a little bit unfair, but did he ever hit those expectations? I don't necessarily know. Again, a conversation for another day. I have Bernard King at fourth, just because I think he had a very similar career to Carmelo Anthony, except his efficiency was just such an outlier at a time when the league didn't really place, at least inherently, a high premium on efficiency. Every season, at least where he played a full year on the Knicks, he shot better than 50% from the field. I think three of his four seasons, if I'm seeing this correctly, he shot at least 53% from the field, which is just nuts. Had the one year where he averaged 33 a game, which is good as Melo was, and Melo led the league in scoring. He wasn't quite that good, though the pace was maybe a little higher in 84, 85, so I'll say roughly even. I don't know. I value efficiency over so much else. I think that's just incredible. And maybe I'm misremembering King's career, so I'd appreciate it if a more tenured Knicks fan corrects me on that. But I just don't think he had any of the tertiary stuff that we take issue with Melo. And then I have Dave DeBuscher at five, and that's one people can pick apart because obviously, like, on an objective level, like, Carmelo Anthony was, and I mean, you could take error out of it, he was a better basketball player than Dave DeBuscher. But my dad has been a Knicks fan since the 50s, and he has driven home to me, like, Dave DeBuscher was just the best. He was always the best, and just reading anecdotal information on that team over, like, multiple books, multiple Wikipedias. Everyone kind of says DeBuscher was sort of the heart and soul of those teams, and trading for him was the reason they turned from a very good team into one that could win a title. So I have DeBuscher at five, and I think just in that sense, he was kind of the antithesis of Melo, not as flashy, but just kind of the ultimate team guy who got it done, and then Melo at six.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. So why don't we So both of us are pretty much in agreement. He's at about in the 5 to 6 range, anywhere from four to six or seven. It's fair to rank him, I think, just based off of success and all that. So then that leads us to the second part. Does he deserve to have his jersey number retired? I'll let you lead with that one since I led the other one.
Right. I'm going to say, yeah, I think. Again, like Bernard King, I think there were less outstanding issues there, but kind of like Bernard King, I think despite the fact that he didn't win on the highest level possible, I think he'll be remembered quite fondly. And I think time has a way of, I guess, making you forget the bad and remember the good, at least in a basketball, in basketball terms. I think kind of like what I said in that first segment, people are really going to focus on that 2012-2013 season, and like, I highly recommend anyone who has 5 minutes go back, watch some highlights from that year. It was an absolute joy, and to me, that's, I mean, again, like, kind of the defining team of my life. So I would want the best player on that team to be memorialized in a jersey retirement, even if I have a lot of other issues on the side with his career. I guess what my argument boils down to is I think his highs were high enough that he deserves to have that jersey retired.
See, I am of the opinion that I don't think it should be. And so I think reason one for that is that he didn't, like, inarguably play his best basketball as a Knick, for one thing. So I think you could definitely argue that that 12-13 season was his best season, but then you look back at some of his Nuggets seasons, and both as far as in some cases, playoff success, like the year that they got to the Western Conference Finals. And just statistically, I mean, you could argue that some of his seasons with the Nuggets were just as good, if not better, than any of his seasons with the Knicks. So that's the first thing that kind of rubs me a little bit. It's like, are we really going to retire his jersey when he spent half his career here and maybe not even the best half of his career, if you're looking at it objectively? The other thing is, so here's the numbers that are retired. By the Knicks, there's Walt Frazier, There's Dick Barnett. There is a combo retired number of Dick McGuire and Earl Monroe. There's Willis Reed, Dave DeBuscher, and Bill Bradley. Those are your first numbers that are retired. Those are all members of the championship teams. So that's so it seems like, at least at first, the qualifier is be a key part of a championship team. And then second, you have Patrick Ewing, who stands alone as like the only non-championship Nick to ever, you know, have his jersey retired. And I mean, he played just over double the amount of seasons that Melo played in New York and played at a high level for every single one of them, made consistent playoff appearances, made finals appearances, made tons of Eastern Conference finals appearances. I mean, his resume, without a doubt, is much, much higher than Melo's. And then you have Red Holzman, who had, you know, the honorary 613 retired for 613 wins. So just based off criteria, I don't think I would retire number seven. I think it would be nice. Like, I agree that it's nice to recognize what he did here. And I'm sure that as time wears on, people will get over the grudges and whatever and kind of look at Melo's time here through a lens of like, you know, what did he do well here? And, you know, that's mostly what I want to remember, you know, and won't care so much about the other stuff, because hopefully 10, 15 years down the line, we'll have like a championship or something, and we'll have a good core and a successful team. And Scott Perry will be having his honorary number hung up from the rafters for being the guy that turned it all around. But even if that's not the case, I just think time eventually heals all wounds and people will eventually look at Melo from a positive light. But I just don't know that his resume as a Knick adds up to the kind of lofty standards that have been set for having your jersey retired as a Knick, which is kind of like championship or like transcendence. And Patrick Ewing, you could argue, was as a Knick, as far as Knicks go, transcendent, you know, as a talent of a guy who was here and played like an all-star for just a crazy amount of time. So I don't know. That's how I look at it. I just don't think that I don't think you can retire Melo's number just for that reason.
Yeah. I guess my only argument would be is I think the totality of his accomplishments as a scorer, and like you could definitely make the case those numbers are empty because they didn't actually really lead to anything all that significant, but I don't know. I think I'll put it like this. I would be shocked if his number does not end up eventually being retired, whether or not that's right or wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I would be shocked if it was retired. I feel like it might be something that gets pushed for eventually by the organization, just to kind of like you said, just kind of make it seem like the whole, you know, everything from 2000 through 2015 wasn't a total shit show. And just kind of as a reminder that there was some shining lights in there. And you can also make the point that he does hold the Garden scoring record too, which we were reminded of this past week, which is, I mean, that's an important thing in and of itself. And that's also the highest scoring game for a Knick ever, I believe too. I don't think anybody ever scored more than 62 on the road either as a Knick. So I think he holds the Knick scoring record as well as just the Madison Square Garden scoring record. So that's something to consider as well. I don't know. He had some serious euphoric moments and moments that will be like burned into my brain forever, like certain shots and certain just, you know, games and the whole 12-13 season and all that stuff. But I just don't know if it all adds up necessarily to a guy that gets his jersey retired. So
one thing that I find kind of funny is that I think it's somewhat unlikely his number is retired in Denver, even beyond the fact of how he forced his way out, which I'd be interested to get a Nuggets fan on here and see if they still dislike him for that, or if they kind of just remember the good times, where you could argue there were even more good times in Denver than there were in New York. But now, given the fact that Nikola Jokic is wearing his number 15 and Jokic looks like he's going to have a far he's starting on a trajectory to have a more accomplished Denver career than Melo, assuming he stays there for the entirety. of his career, like unless they do, I mean, you threw out there the Knicks have two guys with the same number retired simultaneously. Unless Denver wants to go that route, they're definitely going to be retiring Jokic's over Melo unless he suffers some kind of traumatic injury or his game falls off and he gets super fat. But I don't really see that happening. So I think it might be Knicks or bust for our guy Carmelo Anthony.
Yeah, I for the Nuggets, I could maybe see a dual retirement scenario if Jokic goes on to, you know, have like a 10-year, 15-year, whatever career and, you know, plays at a really high level for the whole time. I feel like, I mean, regardless of how things ended with Melo in Denver, I feel like it would be like a serious slap in the face to him to retire it for Jokic, but not like at least honorarily put Melo's name on it too.
That'd be interesting. You can make the case those are going to end up, unless I'm forgetting someone really obvious, those are going to end up being pretty easily the two best guys in Nuggets history. Along with Michael Porter Jr., obviously.
Yeah, Michael Porter Jr. still hasn't played a game yet. I mean, the only other guy I can think of that had a really, really good Nuggets career was, I mean, Mutombo had some good years there.
Namesake, Alex English?
Yeah, I was going to say Alex English. That was going to be the other guy that I said. Those are the only two guys I really think of. Oh, and Earl Boykins. Earl Boykins, mega superstar.
Yeah, of course.
I used to love Earl. I don't know why. I used to love Earl Boykins back in the day. I liked how he played, man. He had some moxie for someone that small. Mm. But anyway, I don't know. We should move on because I think we've kind of beat this to death. We'll probably get into this at some other point too. But I guess general consensus was around 5 to 6 as in all-time Knick rankings, and one yes and one no for getting the jersey retired. So we'll move on to one silly question before we hit another break here, just so we can switch gears, get the listeners less riled up in one direction or another, as Melo always does. So our next question comes from, his current username is Buyout Cantor and Resign Ron. I'm fairly certain I'm familiar with him. His at is Viva LaFranc. I'm fairly certain he had his first name up there for a while, and I think it was Ted. So shout out to you, Ted. If it is Ted, if it's not Ted, I apologize. I see a lot of names all the time, and I interact with you a lot, but your name forever was listed as Viva LaFranc. So I forget you had your like first name up there for like 5 minutes. But anyway, the question is, who would win in a fight? 1 7-foot-3 Kristaps Porzingis, so that's, you know, normal Kristaps, I guess, or 87 1-inch Kristaps Porzingises.
Yeah, so to me, this I'm a nerd, so I spend a lot of my free time reading about hypothetical cross universe or across publication superhero battles online, and like the overwhelming joke in all of them is there a lot of them center around Batman, and they're always the underlying argument is always, well, if Batman has time to plan, he could beat anyone, and they like throw these godlike figures against this lunatic in a bat suit, and they're like, well, you know, if he has time to plan, he's going to figure it out and he's going to win. So I think I'm applying the same logic to Kristaps Porzingis. He has some Batman-esque qualities. I think if the 87, you give them time to plan, they could come up with some convoluted tripwire, maybe made out of teeth floss to like get him to fall down. And maybe like the 87, maybe you just like kind of like run up his nose, kind of start attacking his brain, and that gets it done if we're going to go really dark. But I think in just a random encounter, the 7'3" Kristaps, I mean, this guy's an NBA level athlete. I think he's going to be fleet of foot enough to just kind of smash all these guys before they really have a chance. But I'm interested to hear your take on this, Alex.
Yeah, well, so I'm in kind of a similar mindset, right? So I'm thinking like, okay, what's another, you know, thing that's about an inch long? And I'm thinking like maybe like a cockroach. Like cockroaches are like an inch long, right? And so then I'm just thinking even just about myself, if I had to face off against 87 cockroach sized versions of myself, and I'm assuming that this is in some situation where this isn't going to be like a never ending battle where they could hide and like bide their time and then like murder me in my sleep kind of thing.
Sure.
I'm assuming this is like a battle royale, like fought in a inescapable cage, you know, until it's over one way or the other. And in that case, I think there's no way, like unless the 87 one inch Kristaps Porzingises can find a way to turn themselves into like a little Voltron by forming all into like a mega creature of some sort, there's no way that they win. Like it's not even, if it was like 87, like 6-inch Kristaps Porzingises,
That's then, a different argument.
Yeah, or maybe even like a foot. You know what I mean? Like 87 1 foot things. Like that's like yeah. That's like a small animal. You know what I mean? Like that's the whole thing. But 1 inch, that's tiny. That's like cockroaches. Like you just jump around and squish them. Like you don't even have to like stop jumping. You know, you could just like jump up and down and just keep landing on them until they're all dead. I don't know. I think it would be pretty cut and dry that the 7'3" Kristaps would end up winning against the 87 Kristapses.
And I just say this is kind of a dark question. This is just like you're mass murdering versions of yourself, no matter how you really play this. So,
maybe the psychological element wasn't taken into this. Like maybe big Kristaps can't wrap his brain around this, and like the one insane 1 inch Kristaps, you know, jumps into his mouth and like starts pulling his organs apart from the inside or something.
Yeah,
you never
that's
know.
The guy who's been sharing a locker with Enes Kanter for the entire season.
Yeah, that's like the crazy one. Like, what if they all split into different parts of his personality and he had to face all of his personality traits, and then like big Kristaps was like too conflicted to kill a bunch of mini versions of himself, and then all the like crazy ones like got little tiny knives and like cut all of his like extremities and stuff and made it so he couldn't walk, and then they just kind of killed him. I don't know. That would be the only way I could see it happening. But as long as like he could put himself in a frame of mind being able to kill all these little tiny doppelgangers of himself, he'd be able to do it.
Yeah, it's all about the mental game. I think with that, we will wrap up our second segment. We successfully debated Carmelo Anthony's legacy and talked about the psychological implications about Kristaps Porzingis murdering little versions of himself. We will head on to our third segment where we got two more fun questions for you. That next on Locked On Knicks.
Welcome back in to Locked On Knicks, Mailbag Monday. I'm Alex. He's Gavin. We're answering all your questions. We're finally on to the silly questions because the first one was pretty heavy, the Melo legacy question. That one's never super easy to get through. There's a lot of things to consider with that question. But now we're on to the silly stuff. So I got another silly question that we were asked by Stingy, who goes by @I, though, on Twitter. That's my buddy Jonathan Schulman from Posting and Toasting. Check out Posting and Toasting, as per usual. That's my site. But he asks, who got hugged more as a kid and why? Mario Hezonja or Tim Hardaway Jr.? Now, to me, this question is cut and dry. So I want to hear your thoughts on this one, Gavin. And then I will give my answer because I think it's like a no contest.
Right. I don't know, because I think I was a little more conflicted on this because I think they're both kind of needy in different ways. But I went Tim Hardaway Jr. with the qualifier that I think it might have been by a butler since his dad was playing in the NBA and had other very important things to pursue. And I don't know. I'm actually I'm kind of torn because does Mario Hezonja come off as kind of a mama's boy to you? Maybe. I think I'm flipping my answer. I'm going to go Mario Hezonja. I think he's probably a mama's boy, though. He does play like someone who like always needed more love. I don't know. What you settle this for me because I didn't find this as easy as you did.
I think far and away Mario Hezonja got more hugs as a kid because Hez is like super carefree, super happy. Like he definitely seems like someone who received a lot of praise and was told a lot to just be himself as a kid. Whereas Tim Hardaway, I feel like is constantly fighting to get better and constantly fighting to make sure that he's viewed in a positive light. And I think it's because, and I don't want to speculate too much here, but based off how he talks about his dad a lot, I think they kind of hated each other, like as father and son a little bit. Because I think that Tim Hardaway Sr., probably from the time that Tim Jr. was like, you know, old enough to dribble a basketball, was like grooming him to be an NBA player. And it seems like based off when you hear Tim talk about like when he was a kid and stuff, that Tim Sr. was like pretty relentless in, you know, the pursuit of getting Tim Jr. ready to play, you know, at a high level in the NBA and stuff. So I don't know that they hugged too much. It's even now, like when you see them, like when you hear them talk about each other and stuff, they don't talk about each other as much like father and son. They talk about each other as like acquaintances that have like a mutual respect for one another, like at this stage in their lives. So I would say, and I mean, to your point about the butler or whatever, or Tim's mom, whatever the case may be, I'm willing to bet that Mario got more cumulative hugs between all parents than Tim did from all parents. Because Tim definitely, he carries himself in such a way that he seems like he's always trying to prove himself and always trying to, I don't know, endear himself to people. Like, now it's Knicks fans and things of that nature. So I think Mario got more hugs by far.
Yeah, I guess the heart of the conflict in my mind is like whether Hazonia is like, as you interpret it, like he's always himself and he's kind of carefree. Like sometimes I interpret the bravado as like kind of a cover for a guy who's maybe a little insecure and maybe because he didn't get enough of that boosting as a kid, but it's so like overwhelming. And the fact like that he's not good, but still shoots just relentlessly every time he's in the game. I think that would take just genuinely special psychological gymnastics to pull off. So I think your presumption is probably the safer one. And I will officially switch my answer and say Mario Hazonia got more hugs. Okay, our final question as we wrap up this part one of our mailbag podcast from Don.
Don't take my name.
I'm not going on a lot of sleep. Don't take my name at don't take my name. I initially thought it was do knit ache my name, which is apparently wrong. He asks, which current Nick is most likely to send back poorly made food at a restaurant? And then the flip side of that, which Nick is most likely to just eat whatever is served and not say anything? So this was a long time ago because we've gone quite a long time on this episode. But Alex, I remember you saying at the beginning of this episode, you are more of the school of thought that you would never, ever, ever send food back, which I will say I am also of that school of thought, though I have changed my order before because I'm extremely panicky and anxiety ridden. So I've done that, but I have never sent food back.
Yeah, I'm not a send food back guy. Like, man, one time, there's only one time I ever did, and my food was literally like annihilated. I went to a Chili's and I ordered like the chicken bacon avocado sandwich or whatever.
All right, you're kind of asking for it, but go ahead.
I mean, yeah, it's going to
Chili's. I think just by going to a Chili's, not even your order, but
it wasn't my choice. It wasn't my choice, but it was, you know, we were going there to meet friends or whatever, and I ordered like the chicken bacon avocado sandwich or whatever, and it came out, it was like this tiny ass piece of chicken, like the cheese, they had kept it under like a hot burner, whatever, freaking hot light, that's what I'm looking for. Heat lamp, sorry, word just totally escaped me. Heat lamp, the thing that heats the food. They had it under that for what looked like 25 minutes because the cheese was like burnt and the bacon was like crispy to the point where it was burnt and there was no avocado on it. And fucking sandwich was supposed to come with avocado on it. And even then, I did not explicitly send it back, but the waiter could tell by how pissed I was that the food was like not edible, that the first waiter like ran away because I was not being pleasant, but I wasn't asking to send my food back. And then some other waiter came up and was like, hey, do you want like a new sandwich? Cause that one looks terrible. And I was like, yes, please. This sandwich is fucking garbage. Like, please take it back. And so that was the only time my food was ever sent back. To get to the actual question, so we can wrap up, cause we're starting to run a little bit long here. Current Nick that is most likely to send back poorly made food. I think Enes Kanter would do it and he would be super loud about it, but he would try to frame it like he's just joking, but he would also still want his food fixed because clearly we've seen Enes Kanter eats a ton of food. So I'd imagine he's somewhat picky with how his food is prepared and things of that nature. So I think he would be the guy, he would be like real loud about it and be like, oh, this fucking sucks, like, blah, blah, blah. I wanted this rare, not, you know, well done, blah, blah, blah. And then make a huge stink out of it, but then try to, like, you know, slap the waiter on the butt on the way back and be like, oh, no, I was just kidding, you know. I'm just messing around, you know. And that would be how he would be. And then as far as the one most likely to just eat whatever is served and not say anything, it is 1,000% Frank Ntilikina. There's no other answer, I don't think, because Frank is like the quietest, most polite kid in the whole world, and he would not want to cause a fuss no matter what.
Yeah, I had Kanter, no doubt, as the first one. I think the scenario you described is absolutely right and was perfect, so I don't want to add anything to that. I had Frank as my initial thought for the second one, but I also took into account that Frank is French, and I think there's a scenario where you get, I am stereotyping French people here, where you get a similar scenario to you, where he gets just kind of a disgusted expression on his face that the French have been known to have when they are in a situation that disgusts them. And I can say that as someone who is part French with confidence. So I was also going to throw out Kevin Knox as a possibility because I just remember like how exceedingly polite he seems and like how kind of starstruck he still is by all of this. And I feel like just in his first NBA season, he's a guy that just has zero ego, at least at this point. And like, he just seems so quiet too. Like I can't imagine him even mustering the confidence to send stuff back. Though I guess I'd largely put Frank in that same category. So I think I'm 50-50 on those two.
You know, honestly, honorable mention to Mitchell Robinson too, because he's another guy. All of our like super, super young players are all super like quiet and reserved and polite, it seems like. Because Mitch doesn't seem like he would be the type to ever make us think about anything either. He's got those like Southern values to him.
I could see Trier doing it, honestly.
Maybe Trier. Yeah. That's what I was at. Like the age youngest guys, like right, not right. necessarily like the rookies or whatever. Yeah, Trier's definitely got like a, he's got some self-confidence, you know what I mean? Like he would probably be okay with it. Like he wouldn't be a dick about it, but he would definitely send food back if it was like not good.
But yeah. All right, I think that's all we got, guys. We went over Carmelo Anthony's legacy. We debated Mass Kristaps murder, and we told you how Knicks would handle certain tenuous restaurant situations. If you enjoyed this, we will be back on Wednesday with part two of this mailbag episode, and you can tune in tomorrow for our thoughts on the Heat and Hornets games. Until then, be well and enjoy your week.